Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 484, and hello, bonus episode on a Monday. I never put episodes out on Monday. But I had a chat with Mark Mylod, and it proper blew me away. I loved it. I didn't know what to expect. I've not spoken to Mark before. Mark has got a new film out called The Menu that's out now, which blew me away. So when I was offered the chance to talk to him, I was like, yeah, I thought that film was amazing. Let's talk. And then I was like, well, he did Succession as well, which is one of my favourite shows of all time. Oh, and Game of Thrones, amazing. But then I dug deeper and looked at the stuff he did early on in his career, and I knew this was going to be a hell of a chat. And we only had 50 minutes, but by God, are you in for a treat of a 50 minutes right here. So strap yourselves in. We're brought to you as ever by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. That's where you can get my merch. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can chuck in a dollar a month to support. And Twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo is where you can watch me up to my nonsense all the time. Let's get into this, because this is an amazing chat. You're not going to believe some of the things that Mark worked on. And he spoke so eloquently and honestly about all of it. Honestly, I lined this up as a bonus episode because time was restricted and I thought, well, I don't know that much about the guy. I'm a big fan of his recent work. I don't know that much about his history. I don't know if we'll have a lot to talk about. This could have been a double episode, let alone a full-length one. Anyway, this is episode 484 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Mark Mylod.
Hi, Scroobius. How are you?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
I'm fascinated by your artwork going on over your left shoulder. What is that?
It kind of fits with the menu and Succession a bit. History is written by the winners.
That's fantastic.
It's by a guy who did this thing where he had a realisation that so many of the kind of nobles throughout British history had the money, this is where it takes a turn, to be Batman if they'd wanted to, but chose to just be rich pricks instead and kind of exploited stuff.
I love it as a conscious choice.
So, he did a series of painting kind of masks over all these aristocrats, because it's an interesting time. And you've spent a lot of time looking at the super wealthy, so we're going to talk about a lot of that. But how are you at the moment in general? Obviously, it's, I think all writers, producers, directors are finding it increasingly challenging to write fiction in a world that is so unbelievably, you know, hard to get your head round. So how are you? There's obviously, you span America and the UK. Politically, there's been a lot going on in both recently. Are you well? Are you keeping as sane as can be expected?
As sane as can be expected, yeah. I'm in an incredibly privileged position in that, you know, I live in a nice place in Brooklyn in New York, and I have done for the past 10 years. And I've enjoyed a lovely run of work working with some of the best writers in the world. And so, you know, on a personal level, I'm so blooming lucky. I really am. On a more political level, then, yeah, that's a whole Pandora's box, isn't it? We've got the results of the midterms coming in as we speak in the States today. I can't tell which way it's going to go. It seems to be, it's certainly not the red wave that we feared, but, you know, there's a few results to come in yet. So I'm not quite sure which way that's gone away. Existentially, satire is getting harder. Yeah. Because everything that we, you know, every time we think we're pushing reality, then reality just trumps us quite literally sometimes. that form of storytelling is challenging, and within a fast moving zeitgeist as well. I think probably the most healthy creative approach to that dynamic is just to try to tell good stories, compelling stories with great characters, and let the rest take care of itself somewhat.
And mate, you've been getting to do a lot of that. How weird is it though that just speaking on these midterms, that we've got to the point where, as you say, it's hard to say how things have gone at the moment, but compared to recent years, that feels like good news. Because normally by this time in anything that's been going on, it's just been terrible. Oh my God, so it's a positive now to be, can't really tell at the moment, so that's good.
That's good. No news is good news.
Yeah. It's a really odd situation. Well, yeah. I want to talk to you about the menu and basically a million other things because we've got a decent amount of time, but I can't think of many times that I've been more fascinated by someone's journey when I've started doing my research for this. So this isn't going to be a linear conversation. We're going to jump back and forth on timelines. Right. Obviously, we definitely have to talk about the menu, a succession, maybe a bit of Game of Thrones, but I want to go back to start with because something that fascinates me about the UK, and it's partly because of the BBC, is that shows like EastEnders and Casualty and many others are kind of live training grounds for all areas of a production, not just for actors. I've talked to Michael Fassbender about this, but then I've talked to Tom George about like all sorts of different people have that experience. So how was that kind of starting off for you? Because you started off on EastEnders, right, or have done an episode or whatever. Yeah. How important do you feel that is in the UK as I said, a training ground, an incredibly hard training ground because the turnover is insane and all this, but like, how is that as part of your journey, I guess?
Honestly, I feel it's such a kind of buzzword at the moment, and I said it feels like a cliche, but it's a total truism that I feel genuinely massively privileged and sad, really, to what as I watch, you know, pretty much my whole life, ever since the time of Thatcher, which shows you how old I am, that the whole structure of the BBC has been so besieged and eroded. You know, some of it, one's a little more circumspect, is you know, hoist by their own petard sometimes. But as a cultural institution, it's almost unique on the planet. And if and when it's gone or, you know, denatured to the point of being unrecognizable as a public service corporation, and the beautiful idea of to entertain, educate, and inform that was their original remit. It's an incredibly beautiful thing in the modern world. And I feel that everything that erodes it is a kind of is an empty kind of materialistic rhetoric about, oh, we can't have something that people have to pay for. I just don't agree with that. I think that the service it provides to the country is extraordinary. I know ideologically many people will disagree with that. If my own personal experience of it, I joined the BBC as what one might call a runner or a PA or a gopher, and I worked on everything from Grandstand to EastEnders and the old Blue Peter, as it used to be. I worked on everything, and the chance to just run around and knock on doors and say, could you come to the studio now? And the learning curve that put you on, what you learn by osmosis every day of just being in that environment, for me, was just absolutely priceless. It taught me very quickly that I was attracted to comedy, attracted to that kind of to that light entertainment department, and it just so happened that a lot of the shows I ended up steering myself towards were with these new wave comedians, brilliant comedians, which led me toward working with people like Vic and Bob and the Fast Show gang, Caroline Ahern, and all that gang. And all of that, when I got the opportunity to direct something, gave me an incredible kind of launch into directing with this extraordinary kind of learning curve of making so many terrible mistakes. but luckily working in a place and an environment that was just endlessly creative and kind of fearless.
And learning from the mistakes of others can be the best shortcut to not making your own mistakes, I think. I completely agree. I think being on sets, the osmosis that you get from just being on sets and around sets. I moved into acting from music, so I kind of leapfrogged the kind of EastEnders route, which almost against my own will, because again, I do think it's fascinating, but still, every gig I've got, I've come away feeling I'm a better actor now because of the people I've been around, and not necessarily only the cast, because of the grip I've been around, or a particular cameraman that will teach me something about positioning and these different things. I think, yeah, it's amazing. And I think the importance of the BBC is to continue to give those opportunities to everyone, not just to people who went to private schools and whatever else. And I think it's really interesting because you're right. There has been some hoisting, some petard hoisting in recent years, but it feels like that's mainly on the inform and educate side, sadly. The entertain side, I think, just continues to be absolutely astounding and takes risks that other channels maybe can't take and other organisations can't take. And yeah, it's an amazing institute. We touched upon, I mean, you spoke about things like Blue Peter and Grandstand. I want to talk briefly about a show that was probably the most important show in my life for a number of years, and then probably I've completely forgot about it until I was doing this research today, and it's Maid Marian and Her Merry Men. That was everything to me. I was so into that show. And this is going to sound like such kind of rewriting of history, but that was a strong female lead.
Yeah.
And there weren't that many of them as a kid growing up in Essex, like watching whatever's on TV. Yeah. Again, I may be over romanticising this here, but I loved that show. How was that to be part of?
Absolute heaven. You know, again, you know, working on the likes of, you know, Grandstand and Blue Peter, the fantasy that I had even at that time was to be on location with a single camera and actors and a script that was fun and challenging. And my very first location job was as the kind of gopher on Maid Marian and Her Merry Men, which was an extraordinary cutting edge drama. It won all sorts of awards. And brilliant director David, who was so inclusive. We were talking about, you know, learning from mistakes, but also I'd learned massively from positive influences of what would this person do. And David, and I'm completely blanking on his last name, he was so generous to me. He knew that I wanted to direct and was so inclusive in his process of his staging and the way he'd work staging and photography. I had no idea. He was so just and spread this kind of positive atmosphere throughout the whole cast and crew. It's just a total joy. And Tony Robinson, of course, you know, better known perhaps to many as Baldrick and Blackadder. Yeah. He wrote these brilliant scripts that had this real biting edge to them and that, you know, female empowerment element through the Maid Marian character. It was so fresh at the time and so witty. It was a total joy. It was one of my happiest experiences at the BBC.
I love it. And how does that compare then from that being your first on location job, you know, helping out, running about for everyone, to doing a show like Succession that from the off felt huge? It felt script-wise, performance-wise, direction-wise, I can't think of a show in recent history that from the off was so lauded and so praised. And then each season, more and more, every season, in fact, has had some of the best season finales in TV history, in my opinion. How does that kind of thing compare? I know we're doing a big jump and we will fill in the middle bit as well, but how do those things compare when thinking back and then jumping forward?
It's a connective tissue of it. There's so many who have been around for so long and so kind of passionate about the business for so long. I suppose it's a bit self-indulgent, but if I'm allowed to do that in our kind of mini retrospective going on here, I do love all the, if I look at the connective tissue that leads from Maid Marian to Succession, all the missteps and the luck and happenstance, the connection between, for instance, it's not actually about Succession actually, but as I said, Maid Marian was a lovely, I was the gopher, you know, I was the van driver, I'd make the tea. You know, years later, I got the job on Game of Thrones. And my first experience of it, well, I got sent the scripts and they're, okay, you need to be in Croatia on Tuesday morning in some ancient town somewhere. We've got to do a tech scout with the crew. So suddenly I'm jumping on a plane from New York and, you know, on a red eye, I'm changing planes in Paris and I get to Croatia and I'm completely out of it because I'm so sleepy and I'm a terrible flyer. And I get in a car picks me up and takes me down to this ancient town. I'm up on the ancient walls of the beautiful town, looking over the Mediterranean, drinking coffee down. And there's all the crew there waiting for me. I've never met any of them before. And it's absolutely terrifying. I already feel like a complete imposter walking into this huge drama juggernaut, and I look at them all waiting for me to say something smart, and I hear a little voice out of the crew say, "Maid Marian," and it was this guy who was the key grip on Maid Marian, who was
no way.
The key grip on, and honestly, I could have hugged him because I you know, seldom I felt so nervous walking into a group of people because I was so in awe of them. They all became really good mates. I ended up working with them for 3 years, but there was a lovely connectivity to that journey we'd both taken together and ended up, you know, on this ancient wall in Croatia together. But for Succession, that was, on the one hand, you know, feels quite connected in that my early days was BBC comedy, both in terms as a crew member and then eventually as a director. And then, of course, you know, and Jesse Armstrong, the creator and writer and my friend and collaborator on Succession, had, you know, similar roots as a writer with his comedy writing on the more satirical side. And of course, actually, with Channel 4's Peep Show, which was one of my all-time favorite comedies. Mm-hmm. So we kind of, though we'd never actually met before, we'd moved in many of the same circles. As for the scope of Succession, I suppose that evolved, and Game of Thrones was a massive educator for me in terms of actually, you know, achieving scope and actually evolving perhaps a more cinematic eye. The rest of Succession, just pure instinct, I suppose. But having, you know, having been directing for a while, I have had the benefit of being able to evolve that eye and to find that scope when the opportunity is there. One of the lovely things about Game of Thrones, for instance, and something that I took forward into Succession, was at their best. David and Dan's writing had this brilliant combination of incredibly intimate and then incredible scope. It was a bonding thing between David and Dan and I when I first went to talk to them to basically ask if I could direct on their show because I loved it so much and basically tell them why, you know, I should direct on it. And there was an early scene, there was a scene in the first season of Game of Thrones between Cersei and the old king, Mark Strong's character, where they basically just, it was a very quiet scene, a two-hander, where the two of them are in their bedchamber and they're just talking about the failure of their marriage. And I thought it was extraordinary writing because set in this fictitious kind of semi-medieval world, and yet it felt so fresh and pertinent to any modern marriage. And the intimacy of it and the insight it gave me into Cersei as character, into Lena's character, for all her actions going forward throughout the journey of that whole series, I thought was absolutely priceless and just brilliant character building. And that was, it also happened to be their favourite scene. And so that was a big bonding thing for us. So, and I suppose my ethos has always been character first, the intimacy, the dig into the characters. Why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they making the choices that they're making? And then you can build on that, the outer ethos of how you manifest that on the screen, the scale with which you do that is almost secondary and kind of to a certain extent, you know, if you're lucky enough to have the budget and time to achieve it, is the kind of easier bit because that comes down to a certain amount of obviously craft and guile. But a lot comes down to if you've got a beautiful location, you can probably make it look great if you want to. The biggest trick with Succession is actually to follow the ethos of the show and not to fetishize the wealth, to almost not be in denial of it, but not to notice it consciously. As soon as we start fetishizing, then we're contradicting the very kind of values that we're trying to imbue the story with. So that is a big challenge, particularly when you're in incredibly beautiful places.
I love it, but you're exactly right. Like when I heard about Succession, I thought I'm not going to be interested in this show because I don't want to hear about incredibly wealthy people. But it's the characters. It's similar with Industry and another show that I'm a fan of recently that on paper shouldn't appeal to me at all, but the characters are so wonderful. And it's one of the things I love about the menu is you kind of, again, are getting to look at the fascinating existence of billionaires, essentially. And I think it's a fascinating thing to look into more and more because wealth in general is fascinating to look into because the existence of billionaires has meant that we've had to kind of invent stuff for them to spend their money on. And it's kind of where the menu comes into it. Yep. And high-end restaurants and food and drink and experiences are a big part of that. Like bottles of wine worth millions of dollars aren't worth millions of dollars. We had to come up with something when we allowed the idea of a billionaire to exist because otherwise it is. It's endless. You can't spend it. So how is that kind of thing to look into and to meditate on almost the folly of finding ways for millionaires to spend their money?
I love that question. Well, first of all, I think I probably, you know, in terms of being drawn to that, you know, skewering, I'm probably drawn to it with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, which I kind of learned a bit off at the BBC because in the British film industry, and particularly at that time, I came into it, you know, having like not but literally failed all my A levels, and my dad was a policeman and my mum worked in a bra factory, so I didn't have that kind of blueprint that a lot of the people I was working with had, that they were incredibly smart, they've been to Oxford or Cambridge or they've been to a private school or whatever. And so I had this self-imposed chip on my shoulder, I think, from the off, which I spent a lot of time trying to file down subsequently, consciously or not. But when it came to the menu, and I love this idea, actually, just having to invent, you know, things with a certain value so that billionaires can get rid of their cash. It's beautifully
Both. I mean, it's topical as we have a billionaire trying his best to get rid of as much money as possible with social media at the moment. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or let's build space rockets. Just anything to spend the money on. But I come at it from a slightly different perspective, a more slightly kind of anthropological, I suppose, in that I find it difficult to vocalize without sounding really wanky, but I come at this thing that characters start, or an individual starts, from a place of innocence, and then through our flaws as humans, we kind of take wrong turns and become denatured. And a big draw for me on the menu, apart from, as I said, that chip on my shoulder, Margot, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, giving me that kind of entree into that world as she's being the fish out of water in this room full of very rich diners and feeling out of place in that world, and also kind of calling her version of bullshit on it to her. That was my way in. But Rafe's character, the chef, his place of privilege as one of the world's greatest chefs. When we first spoke on the phone about the role, we both had this, came at it from exactly the same way, not as a psychotic baddie or madman or whatever, but as an artist who'd lost his way, who was consumed with self-loathing because of the cumulative choices that he'd made in his life, and his art being denatured and perverted by his own ego, and that hubris, and by a relationship with money, but with his financiers. And so that underlying kind of poignance of his own flaws and how that has consumed him with self-loathing, I found that really relatable in the way that I think all artists and every individual can look, if you do that fast rewind on your life, and if you were to click through in a certain mindset of all the missteps that we've all made, that can, if you're unstable as that character is, that can take you to a really dark place. The brilliant thing about Rafe, of course, is that he's able to do that and also be hilariously funny, which is the kind of miracle of him as an actor. But I extend that same idea into both Succession and actually going back to Game of Thrones. You know, Cersei, we were talking about Lena Headey earlier with her character, and any of the supposedly kind of evil characters or flawed characters in any of those projects, and let's talk about the menu specifically, all the diners in that room, with the possible exception of Margot Anya's character, have become distorted by ego and a sense of privilege and that extreme wealth in the case of some of them. And the kind of liberation, if you look at the film through a certain prism, that Chef Slowik delivers to them as he kind of strips back their vanities. And a big influence for me was this Buñuel film, The Exterminating Angel, where it's a beautiful film. And I'd seen it ages ago. And as soon as I read the script of the menu, I went back to watch it again. And what struck me was this extraordinary sense of culpability that this elite class of guests have when they find themselves figuratively trapped in this room. But there's this dawning sense of culpability, a sense of guilt, and their place in the inequity of the society they live in. And I wanted to give our diners, everybody in that room, that same kind of journey, guided by the kind of conscience, if you like, of Slowik. So, and stripping them back to a place of innocence, to a place where they were idealists and more kind of before the kind of flaws of life's journey took them to this misguided place. So there's a kind of tenderness to it, oddly, for all the kind of darkness and brutality of the movie. I do the same in Succession for all the flaws of the Roy family. I find myself almost trying to protect them, or at least understand them and all their flaws.
Yeah, and there's a beautiful delicacy with the journey to accepting that culpability that is done with both humour and darkness, because of the super wealthy's reluctance to accept they've done anything wrong. So all of the dark stuff goes on for far too long before anyone goes, hang on, this is probably a bit wrong, is it? Right. There's a lot of denial there. And again, I completely related to that. I talk about this a lot, but I try never to slag off any films or TV or anything like that, because I don't think anyone sets out to make bad TV or bad film. But I certainly know that I've ignored red flags on projects because I'm flattered and honoured to be involved. Because again, coming from a working class atmosphere, not expecting to be here, you are like, oh, wow, how lovely that I'm asked to be in this. And then when something doesn't quite go as good as you think, you do have to kind of sit back and accept, the script was never that great, was it? It was just nice that they were saying I was great and they wanted me to be involved and things like that. So it's a really interesting one. But speaking of the delicacy, one of the things I really loved was Anya Taylor-Joy's character, and she can't put a foot wrong for me at the moment anyway, but something I found really interesting, I don't want to give too much away. It's always awkward to talk about films give spoilers.
So much is to do with the surprise of it, isn't it?
But without giving too much away, her character's job really added an interesting comment to the nuance of this breaking down of the customer and service provider relationship and role in society. And that's kind of the thing that I think Rafe's character is battling with a lot, is he's both the person being looked up to, but at the same time, he is the service provider. He's this revered guy, but he's being paid to do his job. Yeah. And he should be grateful, and so on and so forth. Yeah. It's a weird balance. And I think that's a similar thing with Anya's character. And I thought the thing I really liked was that part was never hammered home. It was touched upon. It was discussed kind of privately and delicately. How important was it to not over-labour those elements? Yeah.
Well, first of all, really important, just because, you know, it didn't need belaboring. You know, audiences are so smart. You do drop the merest kind of hint of subtext and they're onto it, you know. So it just didn't need to be pointed up further. But the ripple effect of that dynamic between her place in her life at that moment and where Chef Slowik, where Rafe's character is, it just provided a really beautiful conflict and tension between them, in that because then not only they are directly in conflict as she's trying to manipulate, stroke, outwit him to escape, basically to survive, if you like, which puts them, of course, in direct conflict. But that is balanced with this deep connection with them, that empathy, that intuition qualities that they both have as service providers in whatever sense. In that they see other people, they intuit their needs and wants and desires for gorgeous food or whatever it may be. And that recognition of those same qualities, of course, binds them together. And although come at it from opposite timelines, in that she is still, however cynical outwardly, is this light, is this force for life. And he is the opposite, of course, who sees himself in this dark place with no escape. And that kind of debate, that chess game between them, for me was always the nucleus, the heart of the film, and that we would build the journey of the diners, and of course the genre story element of this fight for survival through these various courses, that would be built around that idealistic dialogue, I suppose.
Yeah, I love that, and the food element is really interesting. I mean, partly as someone who likes food, it's interesting alone in that way. But just as a construct, a friend of mine, DJ Yoda, I was chatting to him a while back about making music, and he was saying if he's told to go away and make an album, that's really hard. If he's told he needs to put together a Halloween album, sweet, I'm on it. And the beauty of the structure here is the film is presented to us in courses. Was that a handy construct to work with as the director, to know that you've got these segments and you know what you want to deliver in each one as such?
Yes, I think it's a double-edged sword personally, in that I've watched films many times, even when I've enjoyed the film overall, when to be somewhat kind of reminded of the timeline of the experience of watching the film hasn't quite worked for me, when it's, you know, says July and you know the film is going to end up in December and you think, oh, actually I wish we were in October now. In this case, I think we weaponized it in a fun way. It does, of course, give structure, and I totally agree with your mate in that, you know, art, I think, thrives within confines, doesn't it? Whether that be a timeline or a genre, in this case, to build our satirical points and our comedic points within the genre of kind of thriller, horror, whatever, is a really fun box to be in. The structure of the courses, I think, gave us a chance to actually move forward what would be a 4-hour, you know, course into a sub 2 hour story, which, so of course it's a great time. That also gave us a chance to, you know, to, for an extra opportunity for us to have a poke at the whole kind of food porn phenomenon, and to just have fun with that as well, which is always welcome when we're trying to have a poke at the excesses of that particular art form.
On Nicholas Holt's character is key to that, because he's very much the present representation of that world and that obsession. But the cast in general is amazing, and again, I think that really helps, that you at any point I felt you could cut to any of the tables and I'd want to know what they're talking about, because the characters were so good, the cast was so good. Just quickly, one of the amazing cast members is John Leguizamo. He recently put out an amazing open letter about representation in TV and film, and I just wanted to touch upon it briefly. Obviously, it's not something us as two white men really need to debate too much. It's one for us to listen on, but it's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently as an actor who has a stammer but has never played a character that has a stammer. And I work with the British Stammering Association a lot, and we're trying to push for more characters that have stammers or more representation of stammering. But it's such an interesting and weird and muddled world, because I personally don't believe that only actors who stammer should play characters who stammer. Obviously, I want more work, and I like the idea of taking the handbrake off on that as such, because that excites me as an artist. But it's a really interesting world, and I think, what are your thoughts on where we are representation-wide and what more we need to do within the industry, I guess?
I think it's got to be an ongoing thing, hasn't there? I always feel like it's like kind of depressed, I think, when you get a movement like Me Too, for instance, and you know, for a year, everybody will be talking the talk and doing the things, and then a year later, you know, we kind of forget about it, like Black Lives Matter, and then it just seems to be forgotten from the public consciousness in this kind of TikTok of the cultural kind of fast forward that we're all in. So I hope that actually when there is a movement towards actually making, in terms of the performance world, more reflective of our society as a whole and globally, that it's actually got foundations and isn't just the kind of craze of the week, which is, and you know, hopefully with any of those movements and with John's kind of creed de coeur about Latinx representation, I hope that will also have foundations, that will be heard, and that will be, you know, it'll become just expected, instead of just a quick, so, you know, the flavor of the week, which it often is. I do think that overall things have improved. If I look at DGA representation as something I'm quite involved in television, particularly over the past 5 years, I do believe that the Directors Guild of America has made great strides to the point where it's now kind of 50-50 in terms of gender representation in television directing. Film has not got there yet. In terms of on-screen representation, you don't need me to tell you how poor that is in terms of overall representation, as you say, as two white guys talking about it, I'm slightly uncomfortable about that. It's not my kind of pedestal necessarily, but I do feel that when I'm making a casting choice on Succession, for instance, for any kind of role, just to make sure that I question my own judgment and say, who are you picturing for that character, and why are you picturing them? Why do they look like that? And can they not look like that? I think all directors or anybody making those creative choices just has to be increasingly kind of prescient of that and actually mindful of it, to actually make a conscious choice to accurately reflect the world, the story that they're trying to tell.
I think those pauses of reflection are exactly that are absolutely key. As said, although I don't feel only actors who stammer should play characters who stammer, I think actors who stammer should 100% be seen for them and seen for characters who don't stammer. It's been one of the things in recent years that I've been excited in the self-tape era, is I can more comfortably go, well, here's a version not stammering. And if you fancy it, here's a version where I've taken the handbrake off. And this is just, it's not a key part of the character, but that's representation. So I want to rewind all the way back again, because alongside the never credited Trevor and Simon, I think Vic and Bob are responsible for surreal comedy having such a place in the hearts of my generation And Shooting Stars was absolutely key to that. How was that to be part of? Again, I think it gets overlooked as a show that, in my mind, it was the first panel show that acknowledged it doesn't really matter who wins. Yeah. what matters is what we're doing and how much fun and what the entertainment is. And I swear that hadn't been done before previously. Even when it was entertainment-based stuff, people would still be quite trying to win. And Shooting Stars was the first one that kind of went, that doesn't matter. So how was that to be part of such a groundbreaking breaking format?
It was a total joy, obviously. Vic and Bob are still just probably the most unique comedians I've ever worked with, and I've had such a ride of working with some of the funniest people on the planet and just spending so much of my working day laughing my socks off. But they were to the point, I remember being on set with Vic and Bob and seriously thinking I was going to actually piss my pants, laughing so hard so many times. They're just incredibly funny and funny in the moment as well, not just with prep work. They're just the level of spontaneity and brilliance of that surrealist view of the world. Oh, I can't. It was a total joy. I just loved it. Almost actually got fired before I actually started. I'd gone to the head of comedy, John Plowright, and said, can I direct this thing coming up with Vic and Bob? I kind of know him a bit because I was a second AD on The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, and it's such a little, cheap show. Can I direct it? He said, yeah, sure. So I ended up, as the production manager, first assistant, stage manager, location manager, and director. But at the production meeting before we shot the first episode, the producer, who's now a mate of mine, Alan Mark, said, and everybody was there. It was a tiny team, but everyone was there, including Vic and Bob. And Alan said, we're just thinking that maybe, love everything you're doing, but maybe you shouldn't direct it. And of course, and this is my first directing gig, so with my kind of natural imposter state, every part of me just thought, okay, of course I shouldn't. What am I doing here? This is ridiculous. They should have a really experienced director. So I was looking down at my piece of paper, just forming that sentence of, yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, I didn't mean to waste your time. And I could feel tears welling up in my eyes and my face was going purple with the humiliation of it all. But instead of saying, yeah, sorry about that, I found myself saying, no, I think I should direct it. And then I just looked down at my piece of paper and started talking about the next item on the agenda of the meeting. And I just kept talking, finished the meeting and left, just humiliated and waiting for the phone call to say, no, we weren't joking, you're really not directing it. And they obviously felt so sorry for me that they never actually said it. So I went ahead and directed the first episode, and then they never talked about it again. But honestly, talk about little crossroads you come to in your life. Honestly, yeah. I've done what I would in any other circumstances have normally done, which is just gone, apologized and left the desk. Then maybe I wouldn't be directing. But it all worked out well. And the show working on it with their brilliant minds and my ambition to, film these little film clips, parodying, music videos and film clips. And it was just a match made in heaven. We just worked really well together and they became good mates, obviously. I was a total joyful time. I loved it. I really did.
I love it. And as we're getting into the last 10 minutes here, you touched upon working with some amazing people. We can go through The Fast Show, Shameless, Ali G in the House, The Royal Family, all absolutely iconic pieces, but iconic pieces of British TV and British film.
Yeah.
When was the leap to America and how was that transition? Because again, it is famously very different in the style of production, in the style of storytelling, all these different things. How was that change?
It was extreme, to be honest, in that it was a time of, 15 years ago now or more, 15 years ago, I think, where I'd made a film that hadn't worked. I was going through a horrible marriage breakup and trying to keep my relationship with my daughters intact. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I thought I was going to be a filmmaker and I was just making commercials, which was fine for paying the bills, but it was kind of soulless for me. And all my kind of ambitions and, all my plans, God was laughing and pointing, so I didn't know what to do with myself. And I got a call from HBO asking if I wanted to come over and do an episode of Entourage, because the makers of Entourage, which was an HBO show at the time, had seen an episode. I think they'd seen Shameless, the British version that I'd done. And So I said, yeah, I watched all the, you know, DVDs that night, I think, and just thought it's totally different. This kind of blue sky, it's completely different from the Royal Family or from Shameless or anything that I've done, really. And I just loved it. I thought anything just different. I just need to do something different. I need to get out of where I am. So I went over to do one episode and just loved it. I just loved it. I almost got fired on the first day there as well. That's another story. Because, yeah, I know, I'll tell that one another one privately. But I kind of staggered through the first episode and edited it and sent it in, and they really liked it. So they invited me back for one and then another for the season finale. And then they invited me back as, you know, producer, director, the role I played for the next season, next three seasons, and ended up directing, you know, the vast majority of the episodes for that three seasons that I stayed with the show. And it totally changed my life. I actually loved the whole American ethos and way of working. I loved the blue skies. It's that superficial. I really did. And the whole change, the fact that it was so different. And I loved that buoyancy. I met my wife there. I just enjoyed it. I just enjoyed the whole gear change and the whole new challenges and stimulus of that. And it just, yeah, that was it. It was a total game changer. And then I just found myself feeling more at home there. And I liked that I could, you know, pretend to reinvent myself there. Of course, we can't reinvent ourselves. We are who we are. We evolve, but we are who we are. But I just felt liberated by being there, I suppose.
I completely understand that. When I started off doing music, I got in a van and went and played a load of street gigs and open mics and stuff up north. Right. And part of the reason for that was I could tell them who I was there.
Yeah.
Playing locally. I'm still the guy who used to work in HMV or whatever else. Yeah. But going up there, I can be spoken word artist and rapper Scroobius Pip, and they believe it. And it really, it's an empowering thing. I've not turned back since then. But speaking of making those big kind of moves, how was it to jump on to Game of Thrones? Because I've spoken, Elena Heady has become a dear friend in recent years. And I've spoken to her about the fact that, particularly when it started, Lena and maybe Sean were the only real biggish names, and it was all very new people. But by the time you were joining on, they'd all established a family. And you know, although it was the first gig for a lot of people, it was now the biggest show on TV, the biggest show in history, all that kind of thing. Right. That's not an easy one to walk into, right? But as you said, you pitched it yourself and kind of said, I'd like to come and do this. How was that to then jump on after that initial moment of bumping into a Maid Marian and Merry Men alumni?
Yeah, it was pure terror a lot of the time. But, you know, apart from when I get, you know, in terms of the prep and just the scope of, you know, and doing this kind of crash course in, you know, advanced visual effects and just working there and the whole kind of storyboarding ethos that goes with that, which, of course, I'd done elements of, but never on that scale. Mm. So on a craft element, it was just a huge kind of education, and particularly working with what's called previs, where you're working with the visual effects department and basically doing a kind of animation of sequences storyboard them, and then it goes into previs, and that element of just working through and realizing the creative potential of that tool was a great learning curve. I love that. In terms of storytelling, once I get on set and I've got, you know, a brilliant crew, a really amazing crew, and this incredible cast, you know, particularly Lena, who's, you know, probably still one of my favorite ever actors to work with, because she kind of plays the black notes on the keyboard all the time. And she never comes out a scene in a linear fashion. You know, she could be doing the most appalling thing and we'll be talking, and she's saying, you know, and she's just a mother trying to protect her kids. So she'll come at it from a completely human aspect. Yeah. And even when outwardly it seems like the most monstrous thing. And there's an absolute brilliance to that quiet, contemplative way that she approaches the character. As soon as I'm on set working with actors, it doesn't matter if it's a, you know, tiny little two-hander in a kitchen sink in Salford or a big battleground to me, because then it's characters and performance and nuance and finding vulnerabilities and pain. That's my sweet spot. I'm so happy in that zone.
I love it. And I also think whilst on paper they may be completely different, I think your experiences on Game of Thrones must massively inform Succession, because, again, Game of Thrones gets already, I feel, I discussed this a little bit with John Bradley, already I feel gets overlooked for the incredible intricacy of the interweaving storylines of the different families, all this kind of thing. The beauty of Succession is those interweaving storylines. It makes me think of like, I was a big fan of The Shield, and I think that was a show that was overlooked a lot for the way they would paint themselves into a corner that you as a viewer can't see any way out, and then in one scene they're completely out and moving in another direction, and it's just you're sat there as mind blown as you are by a dragon taking down a whole army. Yeah, right. You know, it's trick, isn't it? Equally as awestruck. So yeah, I guess to wrap things up, how was that to transfer those skills, I guess, and bring it into a more intimate story, but a huge story nonetheless?
I think certainly, you know, the appetite I got for scope on Game of Thrones translated really well, and particularly the way that I wanted to enhance and evolve that with Succession. There was a lovely thing. Adam McKay directed the pilot, and there was a quality that he brought to it, a kind of bombastic quality to it, which I loved. It was there was a swagger, so there's a kind of arrogance to it, which so perfectly fitted the kind of early Trump years when the show first aired. And I wanted to carry that forward and just push that more with our, you know, particularly when we try to, you know, replicate the lives of those billionaires. We don't have a billionaire budget, obviously, but a pretty good budget because it's HBO and incredibly supportive with that. So pushing the, it enabled me to push the scope, but very, not economically, but effectively, I suppose. I'm able to capture a scene. I'll always start, I always kind of reverse engineer it. Whenever I shoot a scene, I'll start with the cameras in close. We'll go straight for, and I barely rehearse. I want the first raw instincts of the actors, and then we'll evolve and do our usual process to explore the scene from there. But we'll always start close, and only once I feel like I've got the nuance and the journey of the scene will I start to pull wider and start thinking about the basics of, you know, kind of visual storytelling. I'll always go for the heart of it first. But I've evolved this way of actually getting that scope and scale quite quickly, or pre-planning it. Actually, so much of it is in the pre-planning that even within limitations of series television, you have a certain number of days to shoot an episode, that I can actually carve out time to make sure I get that helicopter shot, that drone shot, or that time of day shot to give us that scope and that bombastic quality that I think is so important to reflect the tone and of the storytelling. So it gave me a lot more confidence, I suppose, and a shorthand for getting to that within quite a limited time frame.
I'd love it. And what a set of actors to drop into that pre-planning. But we could talk about this for hours. I'm going to end it there. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure, Mark.
Oh, mate, I love talking to you. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was an amazing one. I think you'll agree. I'm back on Wednesday. Obviously, this was a bonus episode. Do you know what? Wednesday's one was meant to be a bonus episode, but it was so good, I made it a full episode. Like, we kept talking, like, we had the time. So tune in for that. And then, yeah, loads more. The stuff I've got planned leading up to Christmas. Oh, you're not going to believe it. Tune in on Wednesday. I'll see you then. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.